Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on December 21, 2017. This talk is a fifth of six talks on the Anapanasati Sutta. The Anapanasati Sutta is a discourse from the Buddha on the proper use of mindfulness during Shamatavipassana meditation to deepen concentration. The underlying and supportive theme for this sutta is a group of senior monks well-established in the heartwood of the Dhamma, the Eightfold Path, and their ability to teach a useful and effective Dhamma. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. In order to understand anything that the Buddha taught, it has to be seen in the proper context. It's the nature of a mind that is rooted in wrong views or views ignorant of Four Noble Truths to want to adapt whatever it's coming up against, whatever it's learning, certainly in a philosophical sense, to fit those views rather than to understand the context and what is being presented. And this is something that the Buddha understood upon his awakening. The reason why he taught an Eightfold Path is he understood the nature of a mind that is conditioned towards ignorance of Four Noble Truths and the difficulties that mind would have in keeping things in the right context. So we taught an Eightfold Path. The overall context of everything the Buddha taught was presented in his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. His very next sutta was on the not-self characteristic, anatta, called the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And then his next teaching after that was on the how passions for our own views of the world continues to create dukkha. That's called the Adita Pariyaya Sutta. And in those first three suttas, the Buddha is teaching the three marks of existence. The Four Noble Truths, in a broad sense, speaks to impermanence. It also speaks to the not-self characteristic and dukkha. But in an overall sense, it speaks to anicca, to impermanence. Anatta Lakkhana Sutta speaks to the problem of anatta, meaning the not-self characteristic. And the Buddha used that word that was common at the time, but in an uncommon way. He simply used the words anatta to say that the views that you're holding of yourself are wrong views. They don't accurately describe a self. Let go of the views. And then the third discourse was on the nature of how dukkha arises. So that it points directly to the three marks of existence. And that followed what he awakened to, which is dependent origination, which states from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. And that's when he first taught the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, to describe the results of ignorance of these four truths. So then everything he taught for the rest of his 45-year teaching career was taught in that context. So those can be looked at as superior teachings, and only superior in the sense that in order to understand the rest of the Buddha's teachings, you have to have the proper context for seeing that. And we have that here. One of the reasons why I've waited so long to teach this sutta in detail is so that our Sangha had the right context to understand this. And you'll understand that in just a moment. So inferior suttas are, I don't mean to imply that they're inferior in importance, only to emphasize that in order to understand these inferior suttas, you have to have the context of the superior suttas. So an inferior sutta, even though it's one of the most important suttas the Buddha ever gave, was the Satipatthana Sutta, the sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness, which are clear instructions on how to meditate and deal with what's arising. So you remember that in the four foundations of mindfulness, the first foundation is to be mindful of the breath in the body. And that immediately begins to unite the mind in the body where we are, brings us into what's occurring. It's the foundation for mindfulness. And if you think about that, the mindfulness that the Buddha taught is not some generalized mindfulness, like if you're washing the dishes, you should be mindful of washing the dishes. That's a good thing. But kitchen chores are not something the Buddha was really too concerned about as far as mindfulness. He was concerned about developing mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. So that first foundation of mindfulness, to be mindful of the breath in the body, begins to develop concentration, the sole reason why the Buddha taught meditation. And then the second foundation is to be mindful that feelings arise and pass away. And the next foundation is to be mindful of thoughts arising and passing away. And I'm greatly simplifying the four foundations of mindfulness, but that's what it points to. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness is to be mindful of the ever-changing but present quality of mind. And that's the last instruction that I give on meditation. Notice the quality of your mind when we come out of meditation. Be at peace with your mind. That refers directly to the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Whatever the present state of our mind is, whether it's agitated or blissful or agitated in some other way, meaning from happiness or gain, to simply recognize it, that it's the present quality of mind and it will change. What we're striving for through concentration in the broader framework of the Eightfold Path is a mind that is constantly at peace, constantly calm, a mind resting in equanimity. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha then goes on to describe how once a mind is concentrated, it can hold in mind the other factors that are so important in developing awakening, such as the hindrances to be mindful, how they come up, the five clinging aggregates describing the personal experience of suffering, the seven factors of awakening, and then that sutta concludes, and there's other concepts in that sutta, that sutta concludes with finally to be mindful of Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha's teaching to develop concentration using a proper meditation practice so that we can hold in mind, start developing the Four Noble Truths as the framework for our awakening. In the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha teaches a similar subject, but in the context, and this is an important context, Anapanasati, that word itself, has been used singularly to justify any type of mindfulness practice and any type of breath mindfulness as meditation, often dismissing the entire sutta in which the name refers to, breath mindfulness. So the Buddha is using the Anapanasati Sutta to describe what occurs during meditation, but not as instructions for meditation. And the context of this sutta is the now senior group of monks in the Sangha who has, and his words are, they have developed the heartwood of the Dhamma, meaning they've developed the Eightfold Path to such an extent that they're able to successfully teach others the Dhamma. And that is the overall context. And then he describes to the group, to the large group, novices and senior monks together, how they meditate. And he goes through a series of things that arise during meditation. He begins by describing a meditation practice that is rooted in the four foundations of mindfulness. And then he describes different things that can arise during meditation. So rather than teach that these are things that we should try to develop, he's simply describing impermanent states that arise and pass away. And when a well-concentrated mind is utilizing meditation properly, it won't be distracted by these ordinary functions of the mind. What has occurred is that taking certain sections of the sutta out of context, many people have created meditation practices based on these small sections that have been taken out of context. I encourage all of you to read the whole sutta, and if you even have time to listen to all the talks, because it's such a singularly important sutta to understand what occurs during meditation. And the Buddha always comes back to whatever comes up, be mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath. And the reason why I've expanded the instructions, something I've been wanting to do for quite a while, but the reason why I'm doing it now is now we have the context, now we've established the context. So you understand the reference to the in-breath and the out-breath, to be mindful of the arising and the passing away of our breath. And in so doing, we're teaching ourselves a very important and basic lesson on impermanence. All things arise, all things pass away, including our breath, including feelings, including thoughts, including other things that come up during meditation. Is that clear? Okay. So this is the fifth of six talks, and I'm going to go back to a little bit of what we touched on Tuesday, because it helps synopsize and bring everything into context. These are my words here. Remaining mindful of the arising and passing away of the breath with gentle awareness of the mind avoids becoming distracted by feelings and thoughts arising and passing away, which is, if you listen to all this and read the sutta, that's really what the Buddha is describing. We have become so enamored through self-identification with my feelings and my thoughts and self-identifying to feelings and thoughts that we're describing ourselves by something that is impermanent. In the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, one of the most important lines the Buddha ever taught was, if it's impermanent, it cannot be a self. How could it be a self? Let it go. Just as one whose mind is united with their body, which is what the... Again, this is another important teaching that is often dismissed. The Buddha's whole point of mindfulness is to unite the mind with the body. If the mind isn't united with the body, how can there be any real mindfulness? A mind that is objectifying its experiences through self-referential views, external views, even if the view is of what's occurring in the body, if it's a view rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, it's still objectified and it's still taking your mind out of your body. It's a thought or a thought construct that is either in the past or in the future. It's an aspect of mindlessness when the mind is thinking that way. A mind united with their body would not be distracted by ordinary functions of the body, such as the flow of blood or the processing of nutrients. We don't think about how our blood is flowing and keeping us alive. We don't think about, unless we've eaten some bad food, we don't think about the processing of nutrients. It's just something that occurs. Thoughts are the same thing. It's the function of the mind to process thoughts. It's not a function of the mind to be distracted by its own thoughts. And when we're stuck in self-referential views or views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, every thought becomes a self-referential thought. We cling one thought to the next thought to the next thought because those thoughts are referring to me. And we're enamored with ourselves. We become hyper-vigilant about our thoughts. We become hyper-vigilant about our feelings. Everybody understand that? And so we start blaming the world or the people around us or occurrences for the way I feel. It's foolish, isn't it? Because nothing that occurs, even if it's somebody screaming in our face, should be taken personal. But we do. We personalize everything. The Buddha is saying that what's impermanent should not be taken personal because it leads to confusion, distraction, and ongoing suffering. So notice feelings that arise. Don't be distracted by them. Train yourself to let them go. Notice the passing away. A thought arises. Notice how impermanent it is. Come back to the sensation of breathing. The breath passes away, the thought passes away. We're interrupting conditioned thinking, thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's why a meditation practice utilized as the Buddha taught meditation is singularly effective in developing awakening. During Shamatha Vipassana meditation, breath mindfulness meditation, one remains free of distraction of the ordinary function of the mind to process thoughts. This also shows that the Buddha did not teach to manipulate mindfulness, seeking the trance-like state of mind through blocking sensitivity. I'm cautioning because I don't want to get too far off, but a lot of meditation that's taught in one specific school, and I probably won't mention it, is taught in a way to block sensitivity to what's occurring, seeking nothingness. And the thinking there is that if you can successfully block all thoughts and enter this state of nothingness, that an inner Buddha nature or Buddhahood will arise. Not something the Buddha ever taught. And I tried it for a long, long time and I never found any inner Buddha nature. I finally got to the point, I can remember where I was sitting when this hit me. It was up in a monastery up north. When I finally started, and that what really led me to look at what the Buddha actually might have taught, because it couldn't be this. I had this thought that if there is such a thing as an inner Buddha nature, how did that inner Buddha nature get so confused to leave me in the mess that I was in? And I realized that that's a false teaching, that no awakened human being could ever teach something like that. Anatta refers to all views are views rooted in wrong views, including the view that there is something to achieve by blocking out all thoughts or entering this space of nothingness or emptiness, or that I can chase an inner Buddha nature if I just meditate long enough and hard enough. It's just not something the Buddha ever taught. It may be true, but it's not what the Buddha taught. That blocking of thoughts is another misapplication of meditation. And it was common during the Buddha's time. He studied with two advanced meditation teachers that both taught similar meditation practices of developing nothingness. And the Buddha realized that wasn't for him. Seeking a mental state of nothingness will produce nothing as a result. When breath mindfulness is seen in the proper context, it is clear that the purpose of meditation is simply to be free of the distraction of clinging one thought immediately to the next thought, which is a description of a distracted mind rather than a well-concentrated mind. The quality of mind clinging one thought immediately to the next thought is a conditioned mind clinging to views, self-referential views, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and clinging one self-referential thought with the next self-referential thought. That's why we become so enamored and protective of our thinking, no matter what quality of mind that thinking might be producing in our lives. Because we think it's us, it's all that we know. How can we let go of it? We need a framework, and that's what the Eightfold Path is for. This is a primary strategy employed by a mind rooted in ignorance that continues distraction in order to continue to ignore its own ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And think about all the distractions we have in the world today. Some of the most successful people in the last 20 years became successful because they figured out a way to distract us the most effective way. And we've always paid a lot for people that could distract us the most. And that's not saying think of entertainers. You know, the ones that could really get us going. Frank Sinatra was one for me. I'm 62 years old. Those are the ones that made the most money, aren't they? Because they could really, there's nothing wrong with listening to a good song or whatever else might get us going. But the point is that we'll pay a lot of money for distraction, won't we? And the more distracted we can become from what's occurring in this moment, the more money we'll often pay for that. There's other problems with distraction, not just that it's costly. Anatta, a self-referential ego self, must establish itself, cling itself, to every thought, word, and idea that occurs. In the Paticca Samuppada Vibhanga Sutta, the primary sutta on dependent origination, the ninth link in the 12-link chain of dependency states that following craving, it is clinging and maintaining that one becomes further ignorant of the Four Noble Truths. Those of us who are on retreat remembers the, you know, we really developed that point of what are we going to become? If we don't have something to recognize and abandon our own views rooted in ignorance, we can only become more ignorant. And again, relation to the Four Noble Truths. If we can develop the framework of the Eightfold Path founded on a well-concentrated mind, then in this moment, I can start inclining my mind toward becoming awakened. That's the reference to independent origination to becoming, even though it's almost always left without a modifier, meaning what am I going to become? Because in the overall context, it's left that way, so we have to understand that the potential of each moment is to either become further ignorant, further prone to suffering, or to become awakened. And again, that refers directly to the sutta too. It is the purpose and function of Shamatha Vipassana meditation to increase concentration and not be distracted by the ordinary functions of the mind. Again, the ordinary functions of the mind are to process thoughts and process awareness of what's occurring in our lives and in our body without being distracted by those thoughts. It serves a useful function, just like the heart pumping blood. The Buddha's words. Whenever a monk trains himself... Now remember, I always try to make references gender neutral when I can, but this sutta itself is referring to a group of monks. Whenever a monk trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, satisfying the mind. I will breathe in and breathe out, steadying the mind. I will breathe in and breathe out, releasing the mind. So the intention here is not to breathe in and breathe out, steadying the mind. What the Buddha is teaching is, referring to these senior monks who have developed the heart root of the Dhamma, they breathe in and they breathe out and the mind steadies. They breathe in, they breathe out, the mind calms. Is that clear? And it's really on that missing comma that people don't want to put in here, think that the intention is to steady the mind. The mind steadies as a consequence of a appropriately developed meditation practice. I will breathe in and breathe out, releasing the mind. Do you see? By being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, I've released my mind. I'm not clinging to one thought following another thought. When the Buddha described an awakened human being, he described the quality of their mind as calm, as a result of release or abandoning clinging one thought to the next thought, clinging to wrong views. Frank?
Wouldn't that be the realization of the third truth?
Exactly. And that's the context. Because you understand the context, you recognize that as the experience, the third noble truth, the experience of the cessation of suffering. A mind released from clinging to wrong views rooted in ignorance of four noble truths. Everything is in the context. Thank you, Frank. The Buddha continues. They remain focused on the mind in and of itself. Now, as I wrote the sutta out, I took in and of itself out because it's slightly ambiguous and put in the words free of distraction. But isn't that what it means? When I am focused on something, pick anything, in and of itself, I'm not thinking about anything else and I'm not embellishing what I'm thinking about, what I'm considering. I'm going to read it again. They remain focused on the mind in and of itself, free of distraction. In this, I should have qualified it before I said it. In this paragraph contains the entire Dhamma. So I'm going to go read it again. They remain focused on the mind, free of distraction, ardent, aware, and mindful. Ardent means that we are, ardent can be looked at as right intention. I've developed a strong intention to remain focused in this particular way. Ardent, aware, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. And that reference is self-reference to the world. The second noble truth is craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering, while putting aside that craving and distress that arises from reference to the world, from using the external world, including objectifying who I think I am, to describe myself with reference to the world. And a self-referential ego self is always describing itself and its experience externally with what's occurring, even if what's occurring is an objectified view of itself, meaning taking itself personally. Frank?
I think that's what Siddhartha Gautama is asking everyone to do.
Yeah.
Those truths is to take your own personal experience with suffering, with your own personal experience with craving, clinging, and maintaining, your own experience with cessation, and then finding out how that path kind of works in your own life, like realizing it and then putting into action the path, you know, creating that right balance of effort and action and understanding, and kind of like it all kind of like fabricates in the overall path. Like it is the path.
Yes, yes. Thank you for saying that. You need to keep coming here more often, Frank. But that's what that paragraph relates directly to what you said. It relates to the entire Dhamma, remaining ardent and aware and mindful in regard to the craving and distress that arises from referencing myself, from self-referential views. And notice, again, I keep emphasizing the context that the Buddha, this is something, these are lines that also come out of the Satipatthana Sutta, same words. And in the overall context, in order to remain ardent, aware, and mindful, I have to have a well-concentrated mind, don't I? That's the purpose of meditation. and any other purpose is a distraction from developing meditation as the Buddha taught. And this refers also to other suttas, such as the Samadhi Sutta, the Buddha's description of the jhanas, the four levels of meditative absorption, the Yoganatha Sutta and the Kamsaka Sutta. Those last two, the Buddha teaches the importance of developing shamatha and vipassana, a tranquil mind with the ability to gain insight. That's what shamatha vipassana means. So again, the overall context is important, but the Buddha's bringing all of those teachings together in that one paragraph. I'm going to continue. When this occurs, this monk remains mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath. Free of distraction in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. That one line, the Buddha is showing that when you can develop your meditation to that point where all that you're doing, no matter what's arising, is being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, you have developed that refined mindfulness that, just like Frank just reminded us, allows for the recognition and the abandonment of all wrong views, of all distractions. Remaining mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath in and of itself, free of distraction. That's the whole point of the sutta, the whole point of the four foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, except in that sutta the Buddha emphasizes a few other things that aren't emphasized here. But again, being mindful of these certain factors. This section in the sutta is concluding a section where the Buddha is referring to being mindful of the seven factors of awakening. That is on Tuesday's tape that is referenced to. So again, I encourage you to listen to all the tapes if you can. The Buddha continues. Now he's just brought everything back around to the importance of being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath in and of itself. The Buddha says, I do not say that there is development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is forgetful of these instructions or who is not fully aware of these instructions. Not fully aware would mean not having the proper context, wouldn't it? The Buddha is saying, if you don't do it this way, you're not going to get it. He continues, whenever a monk trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to impermanence. Sensitive means just being noticing, having the sensitivity to notice the impermanence of all things. And again, remember the context, the impermanence of feelings and thoughts arising and passing away. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to dispassion, meaning you understand the singular importance of being dispassionate rather than passionate about continuing to maintain self-referential views. You're sensitive to it. You notice it. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to cessation, what Frank just said. Notice it. Notice the cessation of wrong views. Notice the cessation of the stress that would otherwise be caused by clinging to wrong views. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to cessation. We notice it. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to relinquishment, letting go of all wrong views. Buddha continues, on this occasion, when the monk or the nun or the Dhamma practitioner has developed this level of Dhamma practice, on this occasion, this one remains sensitive to all mental qualities, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. Sensitive to all mental qualities, meaning no matter what mental quality is arising, because I am well concentrated, it doesn't affect the overall quality of my mind or the overall quality of my life experience. I'm no longer distracted by anything that arises in my own mind or in relation to the world around me. Those who see with wisdom and understanding, meaning right view, the relinquishment, the abandoning of craving and distress, are those who have established right mindfulness with equanimity. Equanimity is a mind that is always at peace. Even though it's responding appropriately to matter, no matter what's occurring in its life, the underlying quality is at peace. That's a strong mind. That's a mind that is well framed within the Eightfold Path. It's a mind that can respond to anything that occurs in life with true wisdom and true compassion and true mindfulness. an awakened mind. The Buddha continues, when this occurs, this person remains mindful of all mental qualities in and of themselves, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. This is how mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath is appropriately developed so as to bring the four foundations of mindfulness to their culmination. That sutta culminates with the Buddha describing the importance of holding in mind the Four Noble Truths as the reference, as the framework for our awakening. That's the culmination of the four frames of reference. Give me a second. The next section is what we got into a little bit deeper on Tuesday's class. And I encourage you to listen to it, but I don't want to go through it right now. The Buddha is describing how these seven factors of awakening can be incorporated through a proper meditation practice and mindfulness of them. And that as they're developed, they become a factor of awakening. There's something that becomes a quality of mind that is now a factor of awakening. The Buddha concludes that by saying, when one whose concentration is established, equanimity arises. When equanimity arises, then equanimity as a factor for awakening is established. So again, that can't be taken out of context. We develop concentration through a proper, appropriately developed meditation practice within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. And when that occurs, when it's fully established, then a mind is resting in equanimity. Buddha's words, this is how equanimity is established as a factor or a quality of awakening. The Buddha continues, furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the Four Noble Truths. And I'm not going to say it right now, but he lists what the Four Noble, we all know what the Four Noble Truths. We're able to hold this in mind, not as an intellectual study anymore, because that's how we begin it, but as a framework for looking at the world. We understand, when the Buddha describes awakened right view, he describes it as this view understands at a penetrative level dukkha. This is a mind that has abandoned craving and clinging. It is a mind and a body that has experienced the cessation of suffering. It knows it. That mind knows that it has developed the qualities necessary to cease contributing to its own suffering, its own distraction, because it is no longer ignorant of Four Noble Truths. And then that final aspect of being mindful of the Four Noble Truths is being mindful to understand, like these monks that the Buddha is holding out as an example, that you have fully developed the heartwood of the Dhamma. You've developed the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, in this way, one remains mindful of the quality of mind free of distraction internally and externally. That's another way of saying that this mind is united with its body. It is in its life as its life occurs without any distraction. Is that clear? That's an awakened mind. One remains mindful of the phenomena of the origination of qualities of mind and their arising and passing away. We know that that our quality of mind is as impermanent as all other things and is affected by life as life unfolds. But because we are now well concentrated and we see things correctly, we have developed right view, that mind is always resting in equanimity. Even though it's a mind that might say, the place is on fire, I better get the hell out. Or it might be responding to someone who is very agitated in some way, but it remains peaceful and present and can do some good if it thinks it can do some good. And if it realizes that this is a hopeless case, it moves on. And it moves on without any self-reference or any distraction and any judgment of what's occurring around it. there is a knowledge of the maintenance of qualities of mind and their recollection, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening, in and of itself. That last line, there is the knowledge of the maintenance of qualities. A few, maybe 6 months ago, maybe even longer, I got a question that I never got before from an online student. And it was, why did the Buddha keep meditating after he awakened? And my answer, after I thought about it briefly, was, why wouldn't he? There's a quality of mind of maintaining what we've developed, isn't it? And it doesn't mean that now I'm awakened. It's often taught that when you're awakened, you no longer need the Eightfold Path. Well, you're not developing the Eightfold Path because it's embodied in how you live your life. But you also understand the impermanence of all things, including your own awakened state. And because you've developed that, and maybe even more so once you've fully developed it, you realize the preciousness of it. And so you will have knowledge of the maintenance of those qualities of mind. So now the Buddha is describing, and this is out of the Anapanasati Sutta, but I just want to say it for reference. And you've all, Frank, you've heard of the Nagara Sutta, right? And Greg, how the Buddha describes his awakening. This is from the Nagara Sutta. I came to direct knowledge of fabrications, mental fabrications. Fabrications follow ignorance in the chain of dependent origination leading to suffering. I came to the direct knowledge of fabrications, direct knowledge of the origination of fabrications, ignorance, direct knowledge of the cessation of fabrications, and direct knowledge of the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of those fabrications. The Buddha is describing how he developed the same understanding that he's teaching other people to develop through this sutta. So that concludes tonight's talk on the Anapanasati Sutta. Please read the article, and if you have time, please listen to the talks. This is a singularly important teaching, and it relates directly to our meditation practice. And Saturday I'll conclude these series of talks, and how the Saturday talk relates to how the Buddha finished the Satipatthana Sutta, but also this sutta in a very similar way, where he predicts, if you do this, he promises, if you do this, meaning continue with his teachings in this way, you will awaken. Some people, it might take them 7 years, some people it might take them 7 minutes. But hearing that from a Buddha is just as important as anything else. Any questions related directly to the sutta, and then we'll go around? Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Yeah. And I spent a lot of today listening to the talks and rereading the sutta and your comments on it. It's just, it's so fundamental. It's really like the roadmap.
Yeah, it really is.
It says, this is the roadmap to the Dhamma, and this is the roadmap to the Eightfold Path. And if we could actually just follow that and stay with it, and we will awaken.
We will, yeah.
So we just have to learn it. And then, in our daily lives, then you go on and you're, getting tires put on your car, and then this happens and you're in traffic, and all of a sudden it can go away. But then as we meditate, we can bring ourselves back. And if we bring our concentration, then eventually it'll sustain.
Yeah. Thank you. Think about the setting of this sutta. I mean, I do that a lot. Here's this awakened human being. He's not, he hasn't become arrogant or aloof in any way. He's not, meaning, I think we probably all remember teachers that we've had in college or maybe even high school that were so enamored with what they knew that they were separated from their students. The Buddha's right there with them, with this Sangha. And he's emphasizing the importance. And we do often use the words that the wise know the danger and even the slightest indiscretion, meaning moving out of the Dhamma. And here he's spending this time over and over again, not just this sutta, stressing the importance of remaining focused on the Dhamma and not to be introducing other things and other contexts, other ideas, other embellishments. This is what it is. Remain focused in this way. It's just remarkable. Greg, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. I've heard this sutta before from other teachers that have they've put in their own emphasis on certain things, and it's very interesting to see, as I was learning this, reading it, and I'm saying, Buddha doesn't say that. Like, where is this coming from? And it's just really refreshing to just get into what was said. In the whole context, I didn't have the whole context the first time I was getting into it. Even if I had it, it wasn't, the connections weren't what they are now. And revisiting it, everything is so clear and practical, and you really get a sense of what all the connections being made and why we're doing the things we're doing.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. And it is, again, to overemphasize it probably, you have to have the right context to understand what it was teaching. If you don't, then you can do just about anything you want with it and make it something else. Make it something that serves further distraction. Make it something that serves the continuous need to ignore ignorance. But when you develop it in the right context, the way it was presented, you can't. You can't escape that, because that's the whole point of the Buddha's teaching. Why would he teach something that is distracting? He wouldn't.
I realize now what a large part of what I was doing and why it was so appealing to the large numbers of people that it was attracting was that there were very interesting physical sensations, and it developed this sense of, it wasn't so much about the concentration as it felt really good. And as does this, but in a different sense. And it seemed like it was serving a slightly different purpose.
Yeah, it was serving.
Very easy, it sucked into the sensual, the sensory, the feelings of it. And lose the fact that the importance of the concentration.
Yeah, when you do that, when you substitute, the whole problem of sensory indulgence, in fact, that's listed as the first hindrance, the foolishness of introducing that as a meditation practice. If you have even the context of understanding the hindrances, you'll say, well, maybe I don't want to do this. Maybe I don't want to breathe into my pain and analyze where it's coming from, or breathe into a different part of my... The Buddha never taught any of that. In a practical way, he used the breath the way it's presented. We can only breathe externally and then internally into our lungs. We can't breathe into our foot or our knee or anything else. And again, the Buddha never taught any of that, because that would be just distracting. Teaching to meditate into or on a feeling, to contemplate, or even to contemplate a concept such as compassion or anything else, it all sounds wonderful. But the concept of me as a compassionate human being is a self-referential view. And using meditation to focus on that is only continued eye-making. It continues ignorance. And it's such an important thing to understand. So when you see this description of meditation by the Buddha in the proper context, he's just simply saying, whatever comes up, be mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, and deepen concentration. Thank you for bringing that up. Frank, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays. I like teachings on mindfulness, because I think over the course of meditating and seeing how my mind was constantly distracted in the beginning, how the mindfulness practice is like it's like a gentle gathering of the mind, of the thoughts, and coming back to the breath and then letting them go. And I think it gave me insight into where my thoughts were leading me, whether it was aversion, like you were saying, something about the practice of nothingness and all that. And that sounded like they had a flavor of aversion to it, because I'm in a lot of circumstances sometimes where there's a lot of distracting things externally that I can hear that create thought. And, you know, just acknowledging that and returning to the breath and letting it go, that whole process, I think, allowed to deepen concentration. You know, it was just like a process. It wasn't, I guess I realized it was the path. It was the Eightfold Path. The whole process is the Eightfold Path. And seeing my relationship with pain and suffering, seeing my contribution to it, a lot of times I just can't let go of cravings, and sometimes I can't let go of wanting to avoid something, so I have to cultivate principles that allow me for the craving, for the cessation of the craving or the aversion. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen like that for me. I have to take the action, which I guess would be right effort and right action, to cultivate qualities that are more wholesome than reacting to it. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Oh, you are.
So, like, on a reaction, like something happened today with my father, who came up for a visit. And I wanted to react with something that, you know, hit me internally. And instead of reacting to it, I had to practice compassion, empathy, humility, sensitive to his needs. Like, there was a whole bundle of things that I had to practice when I was in his, presence, to enable me to let go of it. I don't know if that made any sense.
Yeah, no, it does. But you were able to maintain your mindful presence no matter what was occurring there.
The whole time being able to know that, being aware of the craving and the aversion and my own experiences and self-identifying with what I wanted, that all helped in the process. So it was not just a letting go of craving or aversion. It was more of a cultivation of a bunch of things.
You were able to remain mindful of the whole process of aversion and recognize it as such. That's that first part of recognition, and then you continued it with abandoning the reaction to it. Remarkable.
But I think in that point, in that whole process, I saw how, like, what the Buddha teaches about the importance of developing that to go forth and help somebody, help somebody else. I don't know.
Yes, and in that refined mindfulness, we're able to recognize and undo the process that established a conditioned mind. But it's not even a conditioned mind. It's not a permanent structure. It's something that we can recognize and abandon. When you first started coming here and learning meditation, the first thing you did was you developed meditation. And not to put words in your mouth, but the Eightfold Path was something that was unfamiliar and so pretty vague as part of a practice. But as you develop meditation, then you're able to gradually incorporate the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. Does that describe it?
It is, yeah. And I believe the first thing that I experienced was right speech.
Mm-hmm.
That just meditating for a short period of time allowed me to have that little bit of space
Yep.
where I could practice right speech.
And that was the beginning of developing right view. Again, I don't mean to put words in your mouth or in your experience, but what you're describing is how that developed.
Yeah, I didn't know that I was developing right view or right intention.
Yeah.
But it was like, that was the entry point for me, I think, was, and if I'm just looking back on it, that was the very, very first awareness that I had was right speech. I was like, wow.
Yeah, most people.
Yeah, really.
And it... Again, putting words in your mouth and in your experience, and it changed everything. And it changed everything, and it changed nothing. I mean, you're still Frank. You still do what you do.
A path to where I'm already at.
But your experience of your life is completely different, isn't it? Again, excuse me for putting words into your experience. But
no, it's a positive experience.
Yeah. And it is remarkable.
Right?
And that is, again, a description of an awakened human being, fully mature. You see things in, as they are. You're not thrown for a loop anymore. It's just things are what they are. Right, Lisa? Mm-hmm. Good to see you.
They are what they are. Nice, good to be here, John. I'm so glad that you have this Thursday night. I'm liking that.
Me too. I'm glad on both of those counts.
this has been... I've been sick for like 3.5 weeks. And when I'm sick, I get into a lot of me. The self-pity kind of stuff, lazy, like a lot of labeling and that kind of stuff. So it's been an opportunity for me to really use the meditation in a way that allows me to recognize, while I know this is impermanent, it still might be here for like another 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I think what I've been finding is... that there's this story that my ego just wants to hold on to so badly. Just got a little stream of a story. And I did some journaling the other day, and this story goes back to when I was very small. It's the same story. And I opened a journal up 14 years ago, and I saw the same theme that of something that was coming up this week. And it was just a reminder that, like, I could see the change and where I am today versus where I was there. I didn't even know what was going on 14 years ago. Today, I'm well aware of it. I have all these opportunities to show up differently. The relationships where it was showing up in are flourishing in my life right now, which is so, blows me away every day. Mm-hmm. And I just recognize that, I needed to say this out loud, so thank you all for kind of listening through it, is just accepting that this is part of the journey to enlightenment. That, you know, I can bring these practices in. I see the dukkha. I love the dukkha because the dukkha is going to bring me to another place of growth or letting go, really. But there's still a lot of clinging, craving, and desire in there for things that I really don't want. So anyway, I just wanted to just share that. I'm so happy to be back in the seat here and listening again to all of the suttas, and I'm still enamored by the way that you can say every one of them.
Thank you for that. I'm so glad you're here and you're back too. I think what you've learned so well is to be gentle with yourself and understand that it's a gradual process of awakening. And if we find that we're not awakened right in this moment, as long as we're taking refuge, and I mean, that's what taking refuge, the Ratana Sutta was all about that. We know that we're going in the right direction now. You know, prior in these talks, I can't remember when it was, the Buddha talks of recognizing and developing, the word is often used, but joy, rapture, joyful engagement in the Dhamma, because we know from just looking and experiencing it, that it's going to work in our lives, that we can awaken. It's not, you know, it was so discouraging for me for the first 20 years that you can't awaken. It takes you eons and eons and lifetimes and lifetimes. And I just kind of bought into it because everybody said it. The Buddha never taught that. He taught awakening takes place in this lifetime. Take to it like your hair's on fire and you can awaken right now. Frank.
I have a question.
Yes.
Do you think that the Buddha was free of pain and suffering? Or do you think
he was free of... I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Or do you think he experienced pain and suffering, and as a result of it, and his knowledge of how to elevate himself above,
yes,
transcending the dukkha,
he no longer reacted to it. The Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and there's another one too, with the Buddha got ill. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the last sutta, it covers the last approximately 90 days of the Buddha's life. It goes into detail the suffering, the physical suffering that the Buddha was in. He had food poisoning, and he knows who gave him the food that gave him food poisoning. And he gave explicit directions to Ananda to don't even let Kunda, was the cook's name, don't let Kunda know, because he didn't want, for one thing, he didn't want it to seem like he was blaming Kunda. He wasn't, but he didn't want to hurt Kunda's feelings for thinking that he killed the Buddha. Imagine that. And so the Buddha felt this. I mean, anybody had food poisoning, you know, it's pretty awful. I've had it twice. The Buddha went through that with equanimity. I didn't, the two times that I had it. I kind of went crazy in the hospital. But yeah, so the Buddha was a human being. And at the time, he was the most fully human being there ever was. He understood the nature of, the impermanent nature of all things, including physical feelings, including death. You know, he knew that he was going to die. He, in fact, one of these days, it's such a long sutta that I don't know when I'll ever get to actually teaching the sutta, but he knew he was dying, and he didn't take any extraordinary measures. You know, like if somebody said you're going to die tomorrow, you might live the next 24 hours a little differently. He didn't. He just kind of waited for it to come. Ananda knew eventually that the Buddha was going to die, and he was begging for the Buddha, what are we going to do when you die? Who's going to teach us? And the Buddha said, I'm not like a teacher with a closed fist. I've held nothing back. I've given you everything you need for your own awakening. Then he said, decay and impermanence are relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. Those are the last words of the Buddha. He didn't give him any magical instructions or rituals. Take to the Dhamma and awaken. And you will. And when I finally got that, that changed everything in my so-called Buddhist practice. Because it was really what I was looking for. I didn't care about awakening a million lifetimes in the future. That was just speculation to me. But I read, when I started reading what the Buddha actually taught, and then understood the context, it changed everything. It became something that I could practically apply in my life and make a real difference. Lisa.
Yeah, John, I was thinking about what you had said earlier about, and I don't remember if it was a question or whatever, but, you know, did the Buddha continue to meditate? And, you know, I thought about, as you were talking about that, what I was realizing is, like, I have moments where I know I've awakened in small moments in clips of time. And I've even had periods of time where I'm living in a much more awakened state,
yeah,
than, say, I've been in the last 3 weeks. But what I appreciate is the fact is that's why this is still here. Like, in other words,
yeah,
I have to keep doing all of this, all pieces of this.
Yeah.
In order for me to anticipate one day being fully awakened. How awesome is that? But I'm not going to get there if I just kind of hit a good spot one day and say, I think I'm going to slide from, you know, I think I'm going to escape from here. So,
yeah,
you know, it's something that I know for me, regardless of where I am, I have to continue to do that. And the pain and suffering that I have now, if I look at the same events that I did 14 years ago, like, seriously, not much has changed in my life in those 14 years in some respects, that I don't have the same level of pain and suffering that I did,
yeah,
there, that I do now, even though some of the same kind of stuff is coming up.
Yeah.
So I think that's just a reminder to just make sure that I do this.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And that points to the importance of a well-focused sangha. Meaning, you know, we don't... I had lunch with Matt today. We were talking about kind of the subject. It doesn't happen so much anymore here because of the foundations of our sangha. You know? But in the beginning, the first couple of years, it was always people that came in here and wanted this to be different and do other teachings and do other things and, you know, have poetry night and this and that. Again, nothing wrong with all that, except I understood the importance of being singularly focused on what the Buddha taught. And I remember saying that to a few, you know, there's just, if there's only one place, maybe there's others, but there's only one place in the whole world that still just focuses on the Buddha's teachings, let it be here. You know, because there's all kinds of other things we can get into, but this is what works. And this is how we develop awakening. It's not by being distracted from this or incorporating or even treating it like a social engagement, you know. And the Buddha's teaching, reading how the Buddha taught, but also reading the Vinaya, the rules for monks and nuns within the Sangha, were so important. And there the Buddha says, when you're gathered as a Sangha, you speak and interact only on the Sangha. Only on the Dhamma. You don't get into other things. You're not concerned about the chariot races tonight or anything. You talk about the Dhamma when you're gathered as a Sangha. And one of the things that's most remarkable to me is what's developed here in Frenchtown. And on three separate nights. The three different nights, the Sanghas are almost three different Sanghas, meaning there's not a lot of... there's not a lot of people that go from one night to the next. Well, there's a few. Lorna comes to a couple classes a night. It really is remarkable. In the beginning of the sutta, the Buddha is describing and holding up this half a dozen or so monks. And he says, what you have here is rare in the world. Even during the Buddha's time, having a well-focused sangha was rare in the world. And it still is. I mean, that's not good or bad, you know. It's just what it is. And we're so fortunate to have what's developed. And that's all of you. It's not just me. You know, they'd cart me away if I kept sitting here three nights a week talking to myself about how wonderful this is. It's wonderful because of the Sangha that's developed within the framework of the Eightfold Path. It really is remarkable. Thank you all for that. A quick announcement before we finish with Metta. I'm going to start the next 12-week course based on the truth of happiness that we do every winter, and I've been saying that we're going to do it Tuesday and Saturday, meaning the same class on Tuesday will be on Saturday, for two reasons. One, because the sanghas are mostly different, and also if it snows then we can pick it up and maintain our schedule. But I'm going to do it on Thursday too, so Tuesday, and mostly because of Kevin. But I mean, really, I thought about you and Lisa, and yeah. You know, so we're going to have the same. And the way that works is we go one chapter a week through the book until we get to dependent origination and not self. Those take a little bit more time. So the same class will be Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday over the next 12 weeks, beginning January 2nd, Tuesday, right after New Year's. My Wednesday talk will be as it is too. That's become more of a commentary on what's arising between here and online students, and that's been pretty useful too. I'm getting into some nice subjects. And next week, I got an idea in my head that's not completely formulated, but I think next week the three classes are going to be more of just a group share on how you're learning and integrating the Dhamma, and if you have any specific questions. So we'll all go around the room and, you know, each have 5 minutes to talk about how you're understanding the Dhamma, how you've developed it. Of course, as always, you don't have to say anything if you don't want to. But I think that'd be a nice way to end the year, too. So, what do you think about that? Okay. Yeah, okay. So that's what, now. I'll get the framework a little bit more clear in my head, but I think that's what we'll do next week, too. So. Great. Let's finish with Metta, as we always do.
John, do you think now that the mindfulness-based recovery workshop is getting close, it might be worth mentioning to people at the end of class that if they think of anyone in their life or a specific place that they might help with the outreach of, like, putting out flyers?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Actually, let me take some with me.
Please, they're out there. Yeah, January 27th, thank you.
Yeah. I already had a few people in mind and wanted to come along with me.
Anybody that has any type of addiction problem or compulsive problem, which is really all of us, you know, encourage them to come to the workshop. So, have you been to a mindfulness based workshop, Lisa?
I haven't. You and I kind of did it one day together.
Yeah,
but I haven't been to a workshop though.
So it's a way of incorporating the Eightfold Path into those difficulties.
It's from your book?
There's actually a different booklet that I use that probably won't be published. The booklet is called Mindfulness Based
Recovery. Somebody else has already been through it as well.
Okay, good. So yeah, put the word out, take some flyers.
I will.
All right, let's finish with metta as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, becoming mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class, and thank you for those folks that joined online. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.